as far as I'm concerned, as long as that same respect and recognition is not shown toward every one of our people in this country, it doesn't exist for me. And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. Us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Welcome back to another episode of The Malcolm Effect. It has been a while. After a brief hiatus, we are back bringing you so many amazing guests, God willing. Today, it is a pleasure and honor to have our guest speaking to me, and it's a debut on The Malcolm Effect, someone I consider a teacher and a comrade and a mentor to so many of my comrades as well, whose work I find indispensable, particularly in this moment, and we will be diving into it. Welcome to The Malcolm Effect, Dr. Ali Qadri. How are you?
Oh, very well. Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you so much for having me. Let's just go straight into it. And I think in this moment, given the utter destruction that we're seeing waged by imperialist forces, your work on accumulation of waste and how to understand the relationship between war and capital is indispensable. So my first question is that you argue that the global system doesn't just exploit the global south, it actively destroys it. What do you mean by your concept of accumulation of waste, or by waste?
Right. I think, you know, the book should have been called The Accumulation of Capital, because capital is a wasteful relationship. It's a, you know, the generic, the more abstract relation that around which history is organized is called capital. Why? Because we've entered into a stage in history where we make things to sell. And if we make things to sell, we don't care what we do to cut the costs and what's the content of the things we're making, whether they're going to be harmful or not to the general populace. We intend to make profits, and making profits requires that in a competitive world that we reduce costs. And so the reduction of costs literally translates into the reduction of life. Because if we are going to go to Africa or to the Arab world to extract some things, some raw materials, these raw materials are found, you know, there are peoples always that inhabit the earth and live over the raw materials. So we end up, in order to get what we're going to get on the cheap if we're capitalist, we end up massacring the population. And so the first process of production is the massacring process. It is because you need to extract life before you extract petroleum. And that is something that has been veiled over. It's not really talked about much. We talk about extractive industries as if we're going to get the copper or the aluminum or the bauxite, whatever, from countries, you know, which are going to give us their resources, you know, on a silver platter without arguing with us because we're pale-colored people or whatever. Now, that sort of thing is not there. I mean, you know, no one, you know, they're going to basically, they want the resources the cheapest possible. They're competing in the upper markets. So how do they get the resources for the cheapest possible? They need to basically destroy the people who live above the land. And so the destruction of the people who live above the land is in itself an industrial project, right? It involves hiring an army with machines and which are weapons, and the product of the war itself is the death toll that arises from the industry of death, the industry of war. And these are evidently commodified and priced and realized and consumed, you know. So, you know, we consume the process itself on a holistic scale. It is consumed by the aggressors. And there are profits to be made because the war was financed by financiers who are going to earn rents on the, for instance, the treasury bills that go to finance the wars. So if we think about the United States, sometimes people think that war spending is just the defense spending, but war spending is much, much more than defense spending. War spending, for instance, in one aspect of things, it is the expenditure on the bonds that were created to finance all the previous wars of the United States. And war spending is on all the production of knowledge that supports war, on the universities, on the media, and all of these things that are now saying, you know, for instance, in the present moment, Tehran is a terrible place, and therefore it should be bombed, and so on. So this is also an industrial scale killing. I mean, you know, it's not only the sword that kills; it is the word that also kills. So when we think about capital, this primary relationship by which, you know, we think this organizes life when we make things to sell, which is the primary production relations in the age of capitalism. When we think of capital, what are we thinking of? We're thinking of the private appropriation of socially produced wealth. And that socially produced wealth does not come only from people who work in BMW factories. In fact, that's the last stage of the process of production. It comes literally from the people who have died downstream in the earliest phases of the production process. So war and death and genocides and slavery are all primary industrial processes of capitalism, and they are what made capitalism possible. They did not end with primitive accumulation, as often said. You know, primitive accumulation actually increases in the intensity and the scale of killing relative to the historically determined averages. So now people are supposed to live to 100, but they live to 50 or 60. And so the rate of premature death is a huge rate as well. So that rate of premature wealth is socially inflicted, it is socially orchestrated, and therefore it is not a natural thing, it is a social thing. And if it's a social thing, that means it's a social murder. And therefore we have not ceased under capitalism since slavery and genocides of the native Indians and so forth. We have not ceased prematurely destroy people and nature. We continue on destroying people and nature because it is the very destruction of people and nature which is the industry with the highest rate of exploitation, because if the rate of exploitation is understood as the consumption of labor hours in production that were shortchanged, that we paid for so little for labor power and so on, and if we consider that society is what works, it's not the abstract individual, then what we have is a society that is living lesser, a living labor that is not living, a living labor that is dying prematurely. And so the capital relationship is essentially, I'm going to take something from you to make it very clear, and if I'm going to take it from you, I'm going to have to basically destroy you. Either cripple you to spend money for the rest of your life on medication, or kill the population abruptly and all of a sudden. So the rate of accumulation depends on the rate of genocide, structural and direct genocide. And that's something that has not been said. That's a point of fact, it's not a point of opinion. And then I argue that, of course, the empiricism, you know, people's and schools and, you know, capital does not work to produce things. It produces people who accept the things it produces. It produces people who are willing to basically. So it produces the ideas and cripples people with the ideas that it injects into people's minds so that they go into a phase of autodestruction. And these ideas, they're the ideas that basically cause the planet, you know, to, when they become capital incarnate, the population, the masses become capital incarnate, then, you know, the world goes into an act of self-destruction. As we see now, the planet is on a course of auto-destruction. And so these are facts, these are things that we observe, and these are the reality that is going to dawn upon us. And it is here, it's that didn't dawn upon us. Because if we say that the planet is withering in 5,100 years, that means we've accumulated so much pollution and so much death so far that it is impossible to overlook the situation. And so capital in its essence, is a waste relationship. I'm going to waste people and nature before its time in order to basically make, things, make things to sell for those who could afford it, and so on. So really, it's not. It is until if things are said in this way, then the laws of development have to be rethought as well. You know, the laws of development, the laws of accumulation of capital, the absolute law. The questions of degree matter. We no longer, immiserate people. That has to be said differently, because the wording and the meaning of wording has got to drive the message through. We don't just make people poor. We kill people. Capital kills people and destroys people and they come before its time.
Thank you so much for that elaborate response. I think that truly does ground the conversation. I have two follow-up questions then. Could you give the listeners perhaps a concrete example of accumulation of waste, perhaps from the Arab-Iranian region, where much of your research focuses? And secondly, I think when you talk about rethinking the laws of development, I think what you put forward might sound counterintuitive to some people, because we understand that capital, or classically, is the reproduces the work at the lowest level, right? So, for example, when a country is bombed, sanctioned, or destabilized, how does that destruction actually benefit global capital?
The first thing is, if we look what is out there and what is being sold, let's say the things that, from which profits are being made, the weapons are being sold, pollution is being sold. We pay for the impact of pollution all the time, right? We do pay for the impact of pollution and, in health bills and so forth and so on. And the things, the way and the pollution that we are accumulating is also being sold, right? So even when we make, for instance, the example of the lipstick, the lipstick is a general commodity, that a philosopher makes the example of a lipstick. So 90% of the lipstick is waste. Only 10% that is useful to make to serve the purpose. It's 90% of it. And that doesn't go away. The waste is not going to go away. I mean, you have to understand that the cycle of society is not the same as the cycle of capital. The cycle of society is the cycle of the social reproduction of society, whereas capital cycle is meant to adheres to the symbolism of capital, to the accounts, to the booking, to its national accounts, its book accounting, its price system, its units of measure, all of these things that capital imposes. So it has quarterly profits and it has GDP and so on and so forth. But whereas from where we stand, where society stands, over a generation or so, we would like to see ourselves becoming better over time. That's our, to live better relative to the advances of the time, always relative to the advances of the time, because if we don't think about things in relative terms, we are mistaken time for chronological time, whereas time is real time and the foundations of real time are the real material foundations of society. So time is qualitative. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4. It is something else. It is related to the event and to the quality of life at the time. So a number at a specific time may mean something else. We now live, we could live to be 100, but we're living to a lot less relative to 1,000 years ago. So capital can tell us, look, we make you live to 50, and or else if you stayed in the desert in Arabia, you could have lived to 30 under the feudal age. But we are no longer in the feudal age, and we are integrated with capital. And the fact of the matter that the progress of society is ongoing, and that people everywhere could live to be 100, given the absolute presence of crisis of overproduction, which imposes upon an underutilization of resources. So all of this, is basically sectarian and chauvinist talk. That if we didn't come to colonize you, we'd be living a shorter life. In fact, we are living a much shorter life relative to what we could live, because in the past, the reason everybody lived shorter lives was because of natural causes. But now we live shorter lives because of social causes. That means somebody is killing us. And they're doing it on purpose, because they're doing it on purpose because our shortness of life is itself the rate of the shortness of life is the rate of capital accumulation. And that's what it means to economize in the life of labor. Economize in the life of labor is to basically make people die earlier than they could live. We couldn't live longer lives in the past. Everybody, in fact, Africa had a higher life expectancy than the Western Hemisphere prior to 1500. And so it's a projection, like all guesses. It's a projection. It's got problems of projections are always there. But still, I mean, we know that, you know, this wasn't the case. So we now know that every capital totalizes, it commodifies everything. If it commodifies everything, if it makes everything for sale, that means everything has a price. The price could appear at this very moment. The realization that we see it. But everything in the past has been realized. Everything. So if we think about the destruction of nature in Nigeria, for instance, the destruction of nature is not something that's gone away. It is imputed as a cost to society that boosts the profits of capital. So, you know, we suffer from illnesses as a result of the pollution that the Shell Corporation has left in our gulfs. But that pollution itself, we're paying for medical bills, we're paying for everything. So everything is priced. Nothing is without a price. And the price system is a very if we say everything, every social relation is about commodification, then every social, everything has a price. Some prices we see, some prices we don't see, some prices are negative. Like, any price which is negative is like the price of trash, for instance. We pay somebody to take the trash out. You know, that's a way to illustrate negative prices. And there are prices which are implicit, which have been imputed in the process of production in the past to basically gel in the current price that we see now as a phenomenon. So all of the price system is just as a system of social relations that lie underneath the production process, which are not seen. They are seen as something of low prices or low, you know, whatever. And so we price for society over the long term. Everything has a price. For society over the long term, what we produce, we consume. If we produced a lot of dirt and a lot of pollution and a lot of death, we are going to consume this death. It's not going to go away. It's not going to go away. And so the point of the matter is, in the social reproduction cycle, Seslow holds that is, you know, there's a price for everything, and we consume everything we produce. So if you're producing in the lipstick a lot of waste, a lot of plastic, and we're going to throw that plastic away, we're going to consume that plastic, we're going to pay medical bills and what have you. So the production process doesn't stop. The idea to stop things and to analyze things into smithereens is not really reality. Reality is a continuous process. It's a process that we have to take seriously. In any case, when we speak of waste, every bit of waste we are producing, every life we are wasting, every nature we are wasting prior to it is predestined time, that or historically determined time, we are going to consume that and we are going to pay for that. And the more we pay for the costs of production with our lives and our monies, the more capital makes in profit. So that's why the rate of premature death is the rate of profit. The premature death of social nature, nature and society, is the rate of profit. If we look at what this region has offered to the Western Hemisphere, I mean, if we look at the Iranian Arab region and which has been subjected to wars that have caused the death of millions, right? And their death has been a disempowerment of the masses, their incapability of saying, look, we need to retain our what we produce, we need to retain our wealth in order to circulate, so we need to protect our environment. All of this has been related to the death to the premature death of people in this region, to the destruction of imperialist wars. And all of this is telling us, that if we calculate the growth rates of the Western Hemisphere, which are positive growth rates, right? That means positive growth rates under equal distribution, income distribution arrangements, mean that we have positive profits. So the profits of the Western Hemisphere has been, and profits are not made because I go to the store and I negotiate the price of my costs with the store owner. Profits are made because I can shoot the store owner and take all his stuff without paying for it. That's how profits are made. And so the fact of the matter is, this region has been shot. The masses of this region are the store owners, and they have been shot. And that's the reason why we have this positive growth rate, qua profit rate, right? So we have this, this it is related to the death of this region. It is not related to the technology of the West, because the technology, science is always developing, and technology is going to go. If I batter and aggress all the planet, where are the scientists and the technology and the leisure time to produce is going to go? To the North. It's not going to stay in the South. So the real reason why there is technological development in the North is the battering and the killing of the South. So the idea of killing the South is a multifarious process that produces higher profits, it centralizes power, it concentrates power and wealth in the North. And foremost, as I just said, the reason for technological advancement is not the fact that we have better individuals in the North because of the color of their skin or whatever, who are capable of making new technology because they're smarter than other people, which is the so chauvinist undertone of every social science in the West. And the reason for that, the historical causation, the reason why we have that, it's because you cannot, for instance, in Lebanon or Iran or anywhere else, make valuable scientific development because you've been destroyed for the last 500 years. In Africa, you've been destroyed for the last 500 years. So the historical cause, the real cause, that is the cause that gelled into the present condition where development occurs, and it's not because of the genius of the white man. It is because of the criminality of the white man, in a sense. And let's put it in those blunt terms. So it's not, if you're powerful, you can everything is going to go to you. It's the risk-free money. It's the risk-free environment. It's whereas if you're sitting in Beirut, for instance, you next door to you, you can have your neighbors being bombed all the time. And, all the resources are going to flee to the North. All the knowledge is going to flee to the North.
Absolutely. And I think that leads on to my next question. Given that millions of people from the global South are displaced through war and economic destruction, do you see migration itself as a part of the accumulation process?
The displacement, capital stands by the dividedness of labor. First of all, we said that capital, by definition, is this relationship that I take from you, what you've produced socially, and I make it into profits. But I can only do that if labor is divided. I can only do that if labor is pitted, the working people of the South are pitted against each other. And the South is not a geographic, it's a class link. It's not a geographic thing. So what we have is the capital has dual use for labor. First, there's a lot of labor. It still needs some labor that is malleable, that it's going to basically destroy the country from which they originated and then take them to the North to become, to be thankful that they have been, hired by the North and stayed alive relative to their kin who have perished in the South. So labor makes use of that. It's going just like knowledge and money and everything goes to the North. Also, labor edges to go to the North, because that's where, because you have a structure of power that produces the symbols of power. The prices and monies are symbols of power. And, you know, when you're powerful, you can on a piece of tissue, you can say this piece of tissue is worth 100 factories or is worth 100 buildings. You know, you could write a number on it and say, this is $100,000. And this $100,000 could buy you a field of lemons and a field of so on. So you can symbolize, you can impose your symbol, because these symbols are related to your power, upon the population. And, you know, by the fetish of the commodity, the population would kowtow. And unless, of course, they are imbued with revolutionary consciousness and begin to see that the whole process feeds on their death and dislocation. And so migration, of course, is, you know, and when you think about migration, you know, the reason why labor is something of value, you know, when you produce labor, it houses the labor power that the laborer is going to use in the factories of the north. You've invested, and Africa has invested care, a lot of unpaid labor, which actually is not unpaid. As I said, nothing is unpaid. Everything is priced, because these are negative prices. These are societies that are going to tally in the social cost of the reproduction of society. They're going to cut into the life of society, reducing the social cost of reproduction. The outlays on the social cost of reproduction is reducing life, because you pay people less. And if you pay people less, if you pay them less than 1 meal a day, they're going to die. They're going to suffer from hunger. And the reason, and logically, that's what capital intends to do. It wants to do that. It wants to pay people less. And so on. So the idea that that immigrants are good for the economy and they put money back in the economy and regenerate the economy is impossible under capitalism. Why? Because capital needs to always destroy part of labor and take part of labor to employ for the cheapest cost of reproduction possible. That means it's going to take somebody from the Senegal that they didn't pay for their upbringing and for schooling and so on. And they're going to take them and pay them very little, very you know, wages, but which are going to appear very high relative to the Senegal because of the structure of power imposes the symbols of power and it makes the Senegal poorer. But it's poorer symbolically. It's because of the dollar symbol. It's not poorer in real terms. And that's what we have. We have a world which is structured on a path of auto-destruction. Some people call that the autophagic society, but it's from a consumption side. We don't need to look at the consumption side because production is holds primacy. And it's the production side that's going to tell us things. That's going to give us a better, you know, consumption.
Thank you so much. And I just have some final two questions now. I'll ask the first one. If accumulation by waste is built into the global system, what does that mean for countries trying to pursue sovereignty and development?
The idea, you know, you cannot develop without popular sovereignty. You people must own and control the resources. As I said, people are the shop owners and capital is going to come. You know, if you are a master of yourself, and imperialism is a question of control and ownership. Control is ownership. If I control the government, the comprador, that is, any country, because it lodges its wealth in my treasury bills, so I control their lifeline. You know, I control them. I don't need to actually shoot them or anything like that. They are under my, you know, thumb because I hold their monies in my bank. So, and they, of course, they end up, because their money grows by the rate of imperial aggression, the comprador sometimes is much more gung-ho than the imperialists themselves. You know, you've got comprador Arabs who want to destroy Iran more than, and comprador Iranians for that matter, more than the United States. They're hell-bent on causing the death of millions simply because their money grows by the rate of destruction. They're not stupid. They're doing it for money reasons, and that's what capitalism is. So far as stupidity means the shrewdness to make money. Now, so popular sovereignty is the model. You know, you control what you do, what you come and control. You destroy the symbols of capital. You say you are wealthy and you control everything, your resources, you control your labor. And you create a cycle. You retain your resources. You don't allow your resources to go up north for cheap prices. You redeploy these resources. Socialism is about the redeployment of resources within those countries under a social efficiency criteria. It's not a private efficiency criteria. I'm not working my people to make a profit that is in a competitive market somewhere. I'm working my people because I'm going to build the human, and I'm going to recuperate nature such that the future is mine. Not the short-term future, but the far future is mine. And there is no development without controlling your own fate. If the people who control our fate in the North make their wealth out of our own destruction, then there is no development under comprador systems. It is impossible. And these are points of facts. They're not matters. They're not opinions, you know. They're points of facts. That's how they make their money. I'm not even scientizing things. I'm not talking about what is the meaning of the abstract and what is the law of development and all of these things. And, you know, how laws are actually the abstract. I'm not saying things like that. All I'm saying is that people... The facts are, if you develop, and we have, you must be in control of your resources, of human and natural resources. And you must deploy all of the resources, because when you have a private efficiency criteria, a profit efficiency criteria, then you are competing. And you are producing too much for the market, so the crisis of overproduction is always omnipresent. If you are doing that under a crisis of overproduction, then your deployment of resources is less than socially efficient, because you're going to have unemployment and you're going to have factories that don't run and you're going to have land that's not planted. It is impossible to produce for profits and use all the resources. But when you produce for people, then you deploy all the resources and you make things for people. And all the, you know, the historical experiments of socialism, when we follow this criteria, we see that they achieved huge growth rates that are under redistributional arrangements that reinvest in the economy and reinvest in the people. So if we look at China as an example, and of the Soviet Union was an example, many socialist states were an example of socialist development. They worked then, and that's something that Michael Parentius says. They worked then, and we know that, you know, they'll work all the time, because you are putting everybody and everything you have to work at to serve society. And that's okay. When that happens, you are going to have a lot of production. You're going to have a lot of growth. And everybody's going to benefit. And what is socialism? It's putting back into society what you've taken out of society. If you've taken $10 and 10 trees, you put back the $10 and 10 trees. That's what, you know... And, that's what socialism is.
Thank you. You actually answered my next question, actually, but I can ask you if you want to add any final thoughts. I said, like, if the current world order generates wealth through destruction, what would a global system that prioritizes human life over accumulation actually look like? And I guess you're saying socialism then.
Right, that's right. And we know that. We know that societies that were the poorest, like China, they had a life expectancy of 30 years, something around 30 years in 1950. And now they have a higher life expectancy than the United States, and a standard of living that is much higher. We know that society that exercise control over the resources, they have a popular sovereignty, and they redeploy the resources, they work better. We know that. And they work better, they respect nature as well. And because if we stick to the same system, we don't, you know, you can't, okay, the possibility of war and war is around, the possibility of a nuclear conflagration is always there. So a minute or two to midnight or something like that. You know. That's not the issue. The issue is the course and the trajectory by which we are consuming nature only, we are not saying consuming man, is going to take the planet to such a spot where literally the physical social reproduction of life itself is going to become much more onerous, if not impossible. So it is not, the system suffers from, you know, it's like they're all headed towards the abyss. And nobody sees that, you know, we're headed towards the abyss. And that's because of the power of ideology, the power, the imprisonment of people and modes of thought, ways of thinking. That's very important. And symbols of power that act like prison bars before their eyes. They can't see that it is possible, that this all this is unnecessary, because we live in a world that produces food for 12 billion people, and we have starving people. We have, like, many people. So, and that's one aspect of the situation. The idea that everybody could be wealthy and could be better off given the development of the productive forces that we have is not fiction. It's not utopia. We throw away many things. And if we make our money, if the death rate is the basis of the profit rate, then the death rate of the planet of society is forthcoming, unless, of course, people see reality for what it is, break from the prison bars of capitalist ideology and see reality for what it really is. And that is the role of the intellectual, that is the role of the revolutionary vanguard, and this is what is missing. We have a crisis of socialist ideology. We have a because capital has known that buying the intellectual, co-opting them, making them work for the capitalist, talking about reforms and remedies for the problems of society. This is not going to go. This is not going to work anymore. We are not at a point where compromises can be made. The state of the world is not at a point. You know, everything that comes socially and environmentally, everything that comes out that we know of is. And so the idea is for the vanguard to reclaim the role of the vanguard, to basically denudate the capacity of capital to produce the false knowledge that's taken us to the destruction of the planet.
Thank you so much, Professor Ali Qadri. This has been a truly insightful conversation. I will encourage all my listeners to please check in with Dr. Ali Qadri's invaluable work in this time. And until next time, peace out.